It is an absolutely magnificent, beautiful late summer day here in the city of Moscow. You're looking at the Kremlin, and more importantly, you're looking at all the, well, seemingly happy people walking around the Kremlin, tourists and city dwellers who come here every day. You know, the funny thing is, and maybe it's just the right thing to say on a day like this, this happens to be, Moscow happens to be, by far, one of the safest cities in all of Europe. You don't see a lot of crime here. You just don't, for whatever reason. And I say that poignantly because of some of the things that are going on in the world today. It's a sad day. A sad day in my country because it's not safe there in many ways, certainly given what we saw happen last night. So let's get started. Let me start with this. Let me start by telling you the three things that I think you should know about today. It's, first of all, an assassination. Almost caught live on camera. And it's horrifying. Horrifying to watch. And now the question is, who killed Charlie Kirk, right? The man who organized Mr. Trump's youth movement, got him elected, right? There are major details on this that we're going to be sharing with you. Also, what does this assassination tell us about the condition of the United States of America? Does it reveal almost a, you know, does it almost reveal a raw truth about what the United States of America has become? This is the Sanchez Effect. It's a special show. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And we're going to begin with a video that has really already circled the globe. It's disturbing. You may have seen it. You may not have seen it. You may not want to see it. And I understand if you don't, because it's kind of tough to watch. So you're about to see this young political organizer, 31. He's at a student rally in Utah, and he's shot to death, killed. Someone asks him a question, and that's when suddenly the gunman opens fire, possibly from a rooftop behind the audience that he was speaking to, and you will see Kirk collapse. There's close-up versions of this. You may have seen one on the Googles, as they say, because it's out there. But it's really bloody, and it's very violent. So I'm not going to show that one to you. This is a similar, it's the same shot, really. It's the same scene, but from a different angle, from a side shot. We thought this would be a little more prudent, so here it is.
Do you know how many mass shooters there have been in America over the last 10 years?
Counting or not counting gang violence?
Great.
After that, he bled out because he was shot like right in the jugular, and there's no way they could obviously have stopped the bleeding. Dot died just as soon after that. It's tough to watch, isn't it? But it is what it is. Nothing is official yet, but right now it looks like the shooter used a long-range rifle and waited for the precise moment to fire. At first, police detained another man, a Canadian, but they have since let him go. He apparently had nothing to do with it. Now they're looking for who they think the real shooter is, but so far, nothing. There's some images I'm going to show you of where this shooter, whoever he is, was likely positioned to take this final sniper shot. There it is. I think you're going to see the video now. You can see the rooftop of a building facing the stage where Kirk was speaking. It's a long-distance shot, which is why investigators now believe that they're looking for someone skilled with long-range weapons. The witnesses say they saw the man dressed all in black leaving that rooftop right after the shot was fired. So here's the question now. Was the killer politically motivated? Was he loyal to the left, like a lot of people are arguing? Or was he loyal to the right? Who knows? Was he angry at Charlie Kirk for his recent defenses, for example, of Israel, or his controversial support of Trump in the Jeffrey Epstein case? Or maybe just another madman, right? One more in a country that's overflowing with madmen who kill for anything and for everything. We don't know who, we don't know why, yet. But I can tell you this. My country, the country that my immigrant parents raised me in, is broken. Yes, the soul of America is in chaos right now. It's an angry country. It's unstable and it's violent. It just is. Even in Congress today, today of all days, even in Congress, they couldn't figure out how to pray without fighting over it. I'm serious. I want to show you. Watch what happens here. Watch what happens. They ask for a minute of silence among Americans' politicians, and it turns into a 5-minute screaming match. Watch this.
What purpose does the gentlelady from Colorado rise? Let's wait a minute. Wait a minute. The House will be in order. The House will be in order. The House will be in order. The House will be in order.
Can you believe that? They can't even figure out how to pray. Somebody maybe gave them enough money, they'd figure it out. Think about this. America is a country where there are more shootings every year than there are in many wars around the world. It was the case with Afghanistan. More people were killed in the United States when the war in Afghanistan. So America was fighting a war in Afghanistan, but more people died in America than in Afghanistan. Crazy. In the United States, at least 125 people are shot every single day. And every year, 45,000 people die because somebody, who knows why, decided to pick up a rifle or a gun and end a life. It's a place where there are more guns than there are people. And getting a gun is both easy and convenient. Why is it so easy, by the way? Why do these conditions exist? Because the people elected to defend the public don't defend the public. They defend the people who give them money. And who are those people? In this case, in this particular case that we're talking about, it happens to be the gun manufacturers. Simple math, really. You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to go to journalism school, or you don't have to go to MIT to figure this out. Gun makers pay off politicians to the tune of hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars in total, to keep the gun laws from changing. And what do they get? Gun laws that don't change. It's corruption. By any other name, it's corruption. But in America, it's legal corruption. And it's so twisted that even Charlie Kirk himself, in one of his speeches, defended this malignant condition that may have cost him his own life.
We should have an honest and clear reductionist view of gun violence, but we should not have a utopian one. You will never live in a society when you have an armed citizenry and you won't have a single gun death. That is nonsense. It's drivel. But I think it's worth it. I think it's worth to have a cost of, unfortunately, some gun deaths every single year so that we can have the Second Amendment to protect our other God-given rights. That is a prudent deal. It is rational.
So who was Charlie Kirk? He was a young man who figured out how to use new media, social platforms, the internet, YouTube, to reach young people with a more traditional, conservative message than they were used to hearing. He did it massively. He did it successfully. Look, it's very possible that without Charlie Kirk, Donald Trump does not make it to the White House. The same Donald Trump who today made this comment about Kirk's killing.
For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today, and it must stop right now. Today, because of this heinous act, Charlie's voice has become bigger and grander than ever before, and it's not even close.
You're going to hear a lot from politicians after something like this. But really, the story is Charlie, right? What was Charlie Kirk's secret sauce to get Trump elected, for example? Hell of a thing. Well, Trump already had enough support, but most of it came from, like, the Fox News crowd, an audience with an average age of over 70, 80, 90 even. It's not enough to push him into the White House. So it was Kirk who brought and delivered to Trump the youth vote, right? Promising things like no taxes on overtime, et cetera. Kirk was a talented communicator. And what he built was an open conversation, accessible to both the left and the right. And he brought them together many times. I watched it. I would be invited from time to time by his organization, Turning Point USA. A conversation with the right-wing message, but not, and this is what was different about it, it was not an angry message. It was not. He was not an angry guy. He delivered it with frankness. He delivered it with humor, with smiles, good-natured, youthful sparkle. Last night, though, with one bullet, one round, that sparkle is gone forever. After the break, we're going to have this fascinating conversation. I can't wait for you to hear this guy. So his name is U.S. Army officer Stanislav Kropivnik. What's fascinating is he spent decades inside the United States working as a soldier in the United States, in the U.S. Army. And then something happened. Something clicked that made him make a change. He explains that change. He explains what America is, in many ways, where America is today, and maybe more importantly, how it got there from his eyes as a soldier. It's a fascinating conversation we're going to have with him. Don't go away, because we're going to be right back. So it's a fascinating day to have this particular conversation. So look, I love America. I'm from America. I was born in Cuba, but my immigrant parents took me to America. I'm grateful to America because it's because of America that I was educated, that, you know, I was able to experience the love of my parents at a time when my parents needed it because things were a little rough in Cuba in the 1960s when they got out of there and came to the United States. So it's impossible for me not to love and be grateful for everything that happened. But at this particular time, and especially after seeing what we saw last night with the murder of Charlie Kirk, it's hard not to look at my country and say, this country is bleeding, just like Charlie Kirk was bleeding. The metaphor works. America's bleeding from the inside out, and it's bleeding because of corruption, because of anger, because of crime, and a lot of things that are just not working right now. And it's not to be critical for the sake of being critical. It's to be critical for the sake of trying to find a way to make it better. I have my own viewpoints, my own experiences, and so does the man I'm about to introduce you to. This is a unique story. His name is Stanislav Kropivnik. He's a former U.S. Army officer. And despite the Russian-sounding name, he's as American as apple pie because he spent so much damn time in the United States. How are you, man?
Hey, how you doing?
So good to see you. Hey. What'd you think last night? Maybe we should start there. I got to know Charlie. He'd invited me to his events and stuff. Never really got as close to him as a lot of other people in our business, but it hurt me to watch that.
You know, that was a showcase assassination. Because if they just wanted to kill him quietly, they could have killed him when he was coming out of his house.
Yeah.
If it was somebody just wanted glory, they would have walked up there, shot him in the chest, someone with a pistol, something like that. But this was done in such a manner that millions of people, actually the whole world, basically, is going to get to see it. You don't know who did it. You don't know who's behind it. And he had enemies. I mean, let's be honest. He had a lot of enemies.
Yeah.
And not just the liberal side of it.
Right.
He had the Ukrainians. He and the Israelis fell out. Yep. They were screaming at him for anti-Semitism because he wouldn't support the genocide. So there are more than a few interested parties. The deep state. And yet,
with all that you just said, mm-hmm. in the end, there's a possibility that he pissed off somebody the night before, maybe the guy who parked his car, maybe the guy whose girlfriend he looked at. Who knows? In a country where everybody's angry and everybody has access to a gun, who knows?
Yep.
It could be completely apolitical in the end.
But, you know, it in my opinion, anyway.
Now, of course, if the guy had a sniper rifle, it's probably a little... But you know what I mean.
But a sniper rifle, it's a hunting rifle. It's a 30-06. It's what you take out to take out deer. In the woods. I mean, realistically speaking, you can buy it anywhere.
Yeah. And everybody does in America.
Yeah. So. But you know, yeah. I remember, I mean, I grew up, spent half my life in the South.
Whereabouts?
North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Most of North Carolina.
Near Boone? Salem?
Yeah. I was down in Charlotte and then up in Raleigh for, went to university up in Raleigh and then Fort Bragg, obviously, running around those areas. But you know, I remember in high school, guys would drive in with their pickups with shotguns and rifles hanging on there. They got the ammo in there. They're going hunting or they're going target shooting after it. It was fine. But the difference was, you know, in the 80s, there wasn't any antidepressants being written out to teenagers.
Yeah.
There was a drug abuse on the level it is now in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is, what I was reading the statistic, I think like 4% of the population, 70% of the world's scripts.
And by the way, we'll talk about guns a little bit. You want to talk about guns? I'll talk about guns. The gun manufacturers in the United States are making bank by supplying guns to the cartels in places like Mexico and Honduras and Nicaragua. And those cartels are then shipping the drugs, thanks to the weaponry supplied by the United States, into the United States of America, which is making the United States of America the most addicted country in the world.
By the way, so you remember Obama scandal?
Yeah, of course.
Where I think it was the FBI, if I remember correctly. But anyways, the U.S. government was selling confiscated weapons to the black market in Mexico.
Yes.
Flooding Mexico with weapons. And then you got the big cartel war that started off after that.
So the problem runs deep. And it doesn't start just, it's not just about guns. Because you're right, it's a country that's always had guns. Of course, there is a difference between a guy in Salem, North Carolina, who goes hunting on weekends with his friends, and people who are city dwellers who don't necessarily need guns, like these people you see behind us here, but they're all walking around armed in a very dense, angry atmosphere, which causes a lot of crime. So that in and of itself is very different. But what we have in America right now, before we get, because I want to get into your story, but what I fear that we have in America right now is a society that's kind of lost its way because its leaders no longer put the people first. It's
very much so.
As that.
But if you look at it, I mean, look at the differences between the 1980s, first half of the 1990s, and now. Have you taken God out of the country? You really have, out of the schools. You've taken morality out of the schools. Schools don't longer teach morality. You've got broken families, 50, 60% divorce rates.
Yeah.
Single moms who can't keep up with the kids. Who's raising the kids? The television's raising them. The street's raising them.
You're right.
The drug dealers are raising them.
I can't argue with you.
And what do you expect? If you've got kids that have no purpose in life than just to exist. That's what they're being told.
I was just talking to my brother. Like, just before I'm talking to you, I was talking to my brother. I was sitting out here, right here in the car.
That's a beautiful view.
And isn't that gorgeous? And I was talking to my brother, Chuck. My brother, Chuck, is a police officer. He's a captain in the police department in Miami. And he was asking me, and I was telling him, I said, Chuck, you can't even begin to understand how incredibly safe this city is. Mm-hmm. How the people, look at them. They're genuine. They are enjoying life. They enjoy each other. There's political arguments here. Mm-hmm. There's people who think Putin's screwing up. There's people who think Putin's doing great, whatever. Like everywhere else.
Right.
But you just don't see that, feel that animosity. You don't see the homelessness. You don't see the crime. You don't see the anger. You don't see the drug problems. Mm-hmm. Does some of that exist? Of course it does, but not proportionally to what we see in the United States.
Well,
why is that?
Russia in the 90s went through all of that. I mean, it was an economic collapse. That's one. There was a lot of drugs. There were a lot of gangs. The government came in, was the Yeltsin regime, if you want to call it. Yeltsin government.
Yeah, it got crazy.
I mean, they were out to steal. That was the number one reason to be in power. They weren't out to take care of the people. And then when they left and got replaced.
Do you notice what you just said? They weren't there to take care of the people.
Exactly.
Because I just argued that the problem in America is that the politicians are not taking care of the people.
Exactly.
But continue. I apologize.
And then when Vladimir Vladimirovich came in, first as prime minister after Yeltsin left, he became president, then got reelected as president, and so on. The whole scope was changed, right? So the government became focused on taking care of the people. The police became a lot tougher. The gangs went away. And everything got cleaned up because also the jobs started coming back because the industry started building up, right? So people have jobs, people have a future, people have hope.
I'm not an expert on the Putin government, not enough to be able to talk about it as much, but my sense, just working out of here, living here, seeing what I see, talking to people, I get a sense that his government and he personally truly gives a crap about the people that he serves. Like, he stays up till 3 or 4 in the morning trying to figure out how to make sure that the people of Russia are living well enough.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that's not a sentiment I see from the leaders in Germany or the UK or France or many of those other countries. Do you agree with me?
Absolutely. And when you hear from these guys, oh, he's got golden toilets or he's got 20 cars. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, there's a psychological thing called projection.
Right.
There's an old saying, in the market, the thief yells thief loudest.
Right.
So the Western leadership, they're all about making the Benjamins, right?
Right.
Either through special interest or running, being the face of global finance, say Macron. That's a great example.
Yeah.
They're just about getting wealthy. It's getting as much money out of the system as possible, right? So they don't care about that the people in France, for example, the people in Germany are going unemployed left and right. The country's falling apart. It's flooded by migrants that aren't going to assimilate because you can't assimilate that many people. They don't care. They're caring about holding on to power and sucking the country dry.
And making money for themselves by being ever closer every day to the oligarchs in their country.
Absolutely.
And those are the people that run Macron, and those are the people who run Starmer, and those are the people who run Merz and van der Leyen and all of these other people, which is interesting because, I know, I'm going to get to your story, but I love where this is going. Pardon me for going.
No, no problem.
But that's an interesting point you just made because I think this is fascinating. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, you're an expert, not me. There was a time in the 1990s where that same type of thing was raising its head here.
Oh, absolutely.
This country also had some disgusting oligarchs who were robbing the country blind.
Absolutely.
And somewhere along the line, I get the sense that this dude back here, Putin, said, you know what? Enough of that crap. Some of you guys are going to have to pay Mac more. Some of you guys are going to have to do this and this. And some of you guys are just going to have to get the hell out of here.
Yeah, he gave them the option. You know, you can stay in business, but you're not going to stay in politics. Because Berezovsky is a prime example. He was advertising to everybody, I'm the kingmaker, right? I brought Vladimir Vladimirovich to power. He's going to be my tool, blah, blah, blah. Well, he's slightly miscalculated.
And who was that again? Tell me who that was.
Berezovsky. He was one of the biggest oligarchs.
Really?
He wound up hanging himself. Well, okay. He, in London.
One
in
of
London,
those?
He was, he actually, what nobody knew was he had been writing back to Vladimir Vladimirovich. This was, I think, 6-7 years ago. And they had agreed he could come back, and he was going to spill the beans on how he was working with MI6. And all of a sudden, he hung himself. And, no, well, hung himself is what Scotland Yard said. When the Russian government said, we want a full investigation. No, investigation's closed. We looked at it, he hung himself. That's it.
Did he really?
Yeah.
So. And you know, it's funny, as I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm just getting all this knowledge from you, you're obviously a really smart guy, and I'm thinking to myself, here I am, an American journalist. Did you know ahead of time what questions I was going to ask you?
No, of course not.
Yeah, it's funny the way this works, huh? You know, if we were on CNN or Fox News, it wouldn't be like this. My questions would have been written for me by some producer somewhere. Is he the questions here? What? No, there's no questions here. Well, actually, there is some dribble that I wrote. Some notes on you, as a matter of fact. I find, and this is going to freak a lot of people out, in case I've said it before, but I'm going to, maybe it just is worth saying once in a while. I'm a journalist. I'm an American journalist. Studied at the Severide School of Journalism at the University of Minnesota. Proud to have worked at CNN, in newspapers, at NBC, at Fox. I have more control and more freedom as a journalist here than I ever have in my life.
Yep.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh, yeah.
Russia. Yep. Communist Russia.
Oh, God.
The communists weren't even all that communist to begin with, but yeah.
Well, but I mean, I only say that because I still hear my friends who I talk to from time to time on the phone say, are you in a communist country? And I go, no.
I hear that too.
But why? Why are they so stupid? God bless their hearts.
Well, you know, okay. What was the official illiteracy rate statistic from last year? 21%.
Where?
In the U.S.
Yeah. In the U.S.
Yeah. Now, in the 80s, it was like 2 or 3%. Now it's 21%.
Oof.
And that's 21% that reads at a 0 to 3rd grade level America, which is basically 1st grade level Russia, and the 1st grade level Russia. And another 32% official statistics, this is official American statistics, another 32% that reads between 3rd grade level and 6th grade level. That's like a end of 1st grade and maybe 3rd grade in Russia, right? So effectively, half the population's illiterate. So, yeah, you can tell them whatever you want. Hollywood is the teacher of history. You know, you can make up as you want. Most people have no idea. They don't read books.
And the media is controlled by people who want a certain message out. So it's easy to control the people if you can control the media.
Something interesting. Last year, Russia finally had an app for all school grades and all schools in all regions. Russia has a unified history textbook. Because before, there were up to 10, 12, sometimes 20 different textbooks floating around. And interestingly enough, quite a few of them were printed by Open Society, Soros. And that was ended in Russia. But it still goes on in a lot of other countries because the Soros Foundation all figured out you want to control society, you control their history, right? And we just rewrite it. Slowly we'll rewrite it over years, and we're publishing the books, we're handing it out to the teachers, we're paying the teachers to take these books or the principals of the different schools, and we're rewriting your society. And they do that in Ukraine. They did that in Ukraine totally. Rewrote their history absolutely from scratch.
Fascinating.
They've done
that. So it's not just media.
No.
It's in the educational system.
And that's the number one thing, the education system.
All right, finally, I got to get to you.
Okay.
Your story is so amazing. So look at this guy. Put a camera on this guy. What does he look like, right? He looks like a jarhead. He looks like somebody you'd see who's a soldier in the U.S. military. You know why? Because he is a soldier from the U.S. military. How many years did you spend in the U.S. military?
11.
11 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You left two more years as a cadet, but 11 years.
Army?
Yeah, Army.
Yeah. Did you have a rank?
Yeah, I left as captain promotable. Turned down major's rank, which is would have been another 3 years on my contract.
Left in 2004?
2004. Yeah. 18th July 2004.
Tell our audience why you left.
Well, in 99, what really changed my mind at that point, 1999, I was in G3, 18th Airborne Corps. Mm-hmm. What G3 is the operations branch of Corps staff. And Corps, so we had four divisions. That's the 10th Mountain, 3rd Mechanized, 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne.
Damn.
And plus a lot of other assets, almost like a 5th Division.
That's elite.
Before that, when I was at brigade level, when I was at battalion level, when I was at company level, you don't see a big picture. You see your graphic for the next 6 months, maybe a year out, what your training missions are, where you may be getting deployed, things like that. That's what you're looking at, right? But when you get up to Corps level, you start to see the big picture, the really big picture. Except for when we were planning the invasion of Baghdad. And just to understand, planning is, there are plans because, and this isn't just because this is the U.S. Army. Most major militaries work that way. They'll make a plan to invade everybody, just in case. They'll brainstorm.
Of course. Yeah.
They'll brainstorm zombie apocalypses. They'll brainstorm aliens landing on there. It's just something they do.
But you're talking about something more material.
Right. Yeah. So you take the plan for Baghdad off the shelf, put it down, bring it up to date to your actual circumstances, and there's your plan. So you already have like a 70% model, 60% model, and you just work out the rest. Well, except for that, every scenario we were planning out was with war with Russia.
Hmm.
War against the Russian military. We had, and I stumbled across this sitting around. It was a night shift on one of the exercises. I was bored because all the generals are sleeping, the colonels are sleeping, except for the one that gets stuck with the night shift. And I'm a captain, and I'm on the night shift, and I'm looking around the intranet, so the internal internet, and I stumbled across a file that had a write-up on all the Russian generals at the time, and it wasn't just like a Wikipedia,
Right.
Right. This is intimate details. Who their girlfriends are, what their stupid habits are, who their friends are, who their enemies are. I mean, this is CIA-level dossiers on every single one.
Yeah, let me tell our audience why this is important. So, in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, and the United States went to Mr. Gorbachev and to the Russians and said, let's end this crap. Let's be friends. There's no reason why we can't teach you and we can't learn from you, and together we're going to build a better world. We are not going to be your enemy. We are not going to go in there. We are not going to take over all these countries where you were. We're not going to infiltrate Russia. We're not going to do any of these things. What he's telling you is he was there finding out that that was bullcrap, that they were actually doing just the opposite. And the I'm your friend was a lie.
Up to 1999, there wasn't a lot of active measures taken against the Russian government because it was collapsing on its own.
Yeah.
That's what they're waiting for. Yeah, we're preparing, but we're kind of lukewarm preparing because, you know, they're going to die off anyways.
Yeah.
And then Vladimir Vladimirovich shows up and something goes wrong. And Russia gets back on her feet and she's recovering. And that's not the direction that was supposed to go.
Because they wanted it to break up.
Exactly. Soviet Union breaking up was step one. Step two is breaking up Russia as a whole. And or using Russia as a battering ram against China. The same thing they're using Ukraine against Russia.
Explain to our viewers why this mattered to you. Because you had, what, grown up in Russia? What was your Russian heritage or experience?
Well, I was born in Voroshilovgrad. Today it's known as Lugansk. That's been under fire for the last 12 years.
Yeah. Ukraine.
Yeah, well,
Ukraine, Russia now. Ukraine, it's Russia now.
Yeah. The whole area is Russian. It has always been Russian.
Right.
Even after forced Ukrainization by the Bolsheviks in the 20s, it still stayed Russian.
So how'd you end up in America?
My father was a dissident. He moved the family. There was an opportunity. He moved the family in 79,
mm-hmm.
landed in Pittsburgh. Moved over to East Palestine, Ohio, the same one that had the big explosion.
So you're a Steelers fan?
Well, no.
Okay.
spent about 9 months in Ohio and then moved to North Carolina because the company that my father was working for migrated south.
So you grew up in America at the time. I mean, you're growing up in America. You experience America. You are kind of living like an America. And then all of a sudden you join the military and you're fine with and you're excited that America and the United States are coming together. But then you start noticing that America is getting ready to backstab Russia.
You know, I am Russian. I never forgot that fact. And just the Cold War ended. Suppose we're going to go peace and all that. And then you're looking at. The reality is they never stopped planning for war. It never stopped. It wasn't planning for war with China or war with Iran. It was planning for war with Russia, with the exception being when we were already getting ready to go into Baghdad. That's it. The rest of the time, it was all planning for war with Russia. It never stopped.
God, really?
It just never stopped.
So it was like, that's all they ever talked about, war with Russia. Do you think they're still talking about that?
Oh, more than ever. I think after 1999, it went into overdrive. Because up to 1999, it was kind of, we're planning.
Seems
we're
obsessive.
Going through it is, in a way. You can say partially it's because it's still the old, it's the bureaucracy of the military. It's a huge bureaucracy. But I think it's because, I mean, if you look at it. Before the SMO started, Russia is the number one enemy for America. That's what the threat assessments are.
Yeah.
Not because Russia's trying to be the number one.
No, Russia hasn't done a damn thing to America.
What?
It's the opposite. If you look from 1991 to now, Russia has all but bent over. I mean, it's like they've been dumb.
It is. Here's something that most people don't know. The Soviet Union and Russia asked to join NATO 3 times. NATO got formed in 1948. Yeah. The Warsaw Pact was formed after that because Stalin came to NATO and said, I want to join NATO. We want to have security in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to have security in Europe, you want to have all of Europe, including the biggest powers.
Yeah.
But no. NATO was formed to control, as they said, keep Russia out, keep the U.S. in, and keep the Germans down. And that's exactly what it was. It's exactly what it still is. And Yeltsin came in, I want to join NATO, got turned down. Putin came in, I want to join NATO, got turned down. Well, if you don't want us in, who are you against again?
Yeah.
As your border is coming closer and closer to the Russian border. You know, so yes, the Russian government comes to that realization that, yes.
So is it because, as you know, and because you understand energy, as well as anybody, because you've worked in the energy field. Russia probably has more resources than any country in the world.
Oh, yeah. $75 trillion is the last count, and I think that's a low ball.
Yeah, that's a heck of a prize.
Yeah.
So is it that? Because that would be a money deal. Or is it just that we've got an infrastructure where a lot of people are making a lot of money by hating Russia, so we've got to keep that going? Which of those two is it?
Yes. And a lot more than that. Well, okay, look at the evangelicals.
Right.
Since the 1950s, before the 1950s, a lot of the evangelicals thought the Antichrist was going to come from D.C. Then the CIA started working on them. And they got this Gog Magog is going to be Russia. It's going to be the Antichrist.
Oh my God.
A lot of them believe that. Yeah. They have, if you look at it, even going into Israel,
really?
they got videos on YouTube of these end times ministries where they come in there and for tours, and these ministers are like, look, from this side, the armies of Russia and China are going to be coming down, and then God's going to smite them from this side. Just look on YouTube. They're all over the place.
God.
So people get brainwashed into, they're Antichrist, they're communist. They're the enemies of everything, and grandma and apple pie and everything
else. They sleep with bears.
They sleep with bears and an AK and a bottle of vodka, which, by the way, the drink Russia is
I've noticed that. Every time I'm at a bar, even with some of the people I work with here, it's like I say, hey, let's have vodka. They go, nobody here drinks
vodka. Let's have a beer.
Exactly. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
In many ways, I was talking to my brother about this. When I look at Russia, I see America in the 1960s.
60s, 70s, even in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And that was the golden age. I mean, if we're going to talk about reality, as far as I think, anyways, maybe it's because I grew up at that time.
And by the way, without the racism. Because I know a lot of you are listening to me, oh, yeah, that's great, Sanchez. What would it have been like to be a black person back then? I know that in America at that time, there was a lot of racial strife. They just happen to not have a lot of race issues here because of the demographics.
It's not just the demographics. If you look at even medieval Russia, we had Asiatic peoples coming through, nomads. We'd fight wars with them, and usually when a war ended, you know how the war ended? Whatever Han was going got defeated, he'd give his daughter up for marriage to a Russian prince.
Hmm.
So you already have mixture of races. And that wasn't something that people were against. That wasn't this. The Europeans had this thing about, those are dirty people. You don't mix with them. Russia's never had that issue. It never had that. If you look at the American Indians in Alaska, there was a study done, and it was said that almost every single family, every single Indian family, has at least one Russian ancestor.
Yeah, of course.
Because the Russian fur traders and the Russian Cossacks that came and settled, most didn't come with their wives,
right.
And they just married local women.
Even in parts of California, around the Russian River, where, by the way, some of the best wine in the world is made.
Fort Rose.
Here's what's interesting about all of this. The stories you're telling about hearing and understanding and living through a time in history where you realized that with this Russia phobia that was just effervescent and omnipresent.
Oh, yeah.
I see it now mostly in Europe. I was reading a speech, I think, by van der Leyen last night. And I hear the same thing, as you guys know who watch our show. She's the head of the EU. And from her and Merz and Starmer and Macron, they paint Russia as this just evil, horrible people and society and country that needs to be put down at all costs. But they don't explain why. It's like, it's weird, isn't it?
It is.
And it's prejudice.
I think they all have different reasons for it. Kaya Kallas, for example, I mean, she's a stupid woman.
She is indeed, honest.
And she talks about, we know what occupation is like. We lived in Estonian occupation. Her father was a high-placed member of the Soviet elite. She grew up with a silver spoon in her mouth.
Yeah.
So, and her husband, by the way, is possible. I don't know if he's still making money off it, but he made his millions off of working with the Russian industry.
Really?
Transportation.
Huh.
Yeah. So you got right there. But she's made her position.
She's the chief diplomat of the entire continent.
Oh, yeah.
And
well,
the things
if you can call
that she says are just so dumb.
Then you get Macron. Macron's problem is, realistically, there's hundreds, if not 1,000+ dead Frenchmen all over the battlefield. He's got to explain that. It's popped out a few times.
What battlefield? Which one? You mean in Russia?
Yeah, on the line of contact. There are French all over the place, as mercenaries, as trainers, and so on. So he's got to explain that.
You mean in Ukraine you're talking
about?
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So how is he going to explain that? That he's been sending people over, quote, as mercenaries? Yeah, that's a little hard to explain because he's saying that, you know, there's no French troops there. But if the French troops arrive there and they're taking casualties, you can just take all of that and just cover it right up.
So it's...
And get away with murder, literally having your own people killed off. That's the French. Then you get to the British. The British have another problem. England's on the edge of civil war. Mm. 2 weeks ago, I was watching a BBC program. They had a vice minister of defense. I don't remember his name. But he's saying, you know, we've got to admit to ourselves we're at war with Russia. We're already at war. Because they don't want to declare war. Well, I'm getting it. They don't want to declare war because then bad things will come flying their way. But we're at war with Russia. Society has to understand we're at war with Russia. And we have to take control of society. We have to have martial law. So Russia becomes this very good excuse to have martial law, crack down on your society that's having 10, 20 protests a day against the government. Mm-hmm. Starmer is about as popular as herpes.
23%.
Amazingly, 23% still vote for that.
You're impressed, huh?
Yeah. I think Macron is up
27.
Down. Yeah, well, yeah. Again, wow. It says the low information voter or the guy making money off of it. So different reasons. And then you get Merz. Who I think he's got his Nazi past, he just won't let him rest in peace. You know, that guy.
They have to. So what you're saying is they have to convince their citizenry that there's something more important than the fact that their wages have never been lower, the fact that there are immigrants everywhere that are, and I'm not against, I'm an immigrant, but I mean, it's to the point where they are controlling the cities and doing everything in those parts of the world. And that inflation is through the roof. So what they're saying is, don't look at that squirrel.
Yeah.
Squirrel.
Yeah.
And the squirrel is Russia.
Absolutely.
And that's the only reason you hear they have to be in war with Russia. They have to continue feeding Ukraine. But so if they stop doing that, they think they'd be done the next day? Because people would notice the real problems?
I think so, absolutely. You've got a lot of populist parties on the edges. They're screaming like, well, some on the edges. Then you got AFD when their politicians aren't suddenly dropping dead in whole packs. You know, seven guys in 2 weeks. Statistically, I've actually read a few statistical analyses. I'm like, this is impossible. That many people in 7 to 10 days.
So what about our country? Mm-hmm. Kidding, but my country, and to a certain extent your country. There's a part of America I could tell in you. It's culturally there. Do you think they're different than Europe, especially under Trump, or do you think, like I do, that he's having a hard time resisting the sway of America's oligarchs who tend to be in that defense industry?
Well, it's not just defense industry. Defense industry these days is pretty wide. You've got the biochemical industry that's, by the way, feeding the Ukrainian army amphetamines and other drugs in the rations nowadays.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Since 2014, when it was just a civil war. Now, a lot of the guys on the rebel side were saying, you know, the Ukrainian troops were just getting up and walking like zombies into fire. There's no that reaction of dropping and trying to seek cover when you're being shot at. They're just walking in because they're stoned up on amphetamines.
Really?
I came in.
And who's giving it to them?
Oh, the West, the U.S. Well, amphetamines were what the Nazis were using to keep their soldiers marching.
Speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when I came into Svatova about a week and a half after it was taken, we brought in medical equipment to a hospital. It was a military hospital, field hospital for the civilians and for the military. And I was talking to the doctors, like, you know, for the last week and a half, all we're doing is walking around, picking up all the syringes and all the amphetamines that these guys were poking themselves with day in and day out, one of the Nazi battalions that was sitting there. So this is widespread. I talked to a journalist, a Russian journalist, who did a documentary on the POW camps.
Yeah.
He said one-third of the POWs don't survive the first 2 weeks because they start getting the bends. They're off the drugs and they have organ failure.
Massive. Seriously?
Organ failure.
These are the soldiers who've been captured by the Russian army.
Yes, or surrendered.
Or have surrendered.
Right.
And they
a
die.
A third of them don't survive.
From withdrawals.
Withdrawals. Yeah, they get the bends. They get, I mean, we're not just talking regular street line amphetamine.
Damn.
I mean, this is the strongest stuff they can produce for them, and they're on it.
And who makes a decision to give these poor suckers that stuff?
Who makes a decision to give anything to them?
Zelensky. Well, is it coming from the top?
Well, Zelensky is a puppet. It's coming from the West. It's coming from Big Pharma. It's coming. Wait a minute. Who brought in
I've never heard this story.
Who
this
brought
is
in
fascinating.
Most of the morphine and heroin from legally brought it into the U.S. from Afghanistan?
Yeah.
You know, once NATO came into Afghanistan, every year, almost every year, was a record crop in,
exactly.
in opium.
And since we left Afghanistan, it's dropped like 60%.
They burned the crops.
Yeah.
They're now growing wheat and corn, right?
Think about what you just said. And this hurts to say it. My country, the United States of America, when we were in Afghanistan and we controlled Afghanistan, we increased the heroin supply that came out of Afghanistan by something like 35 to 40%.
More than that. More than that.
Really?
It was it went from almost zero under the Taliban, whatever you want to say about the Taliban, it went from almost zero under the Taliban to massive quantities from year one.
God.
And this was with modern technology. Most of these drugs came into the U.S. legally, got stamped out into prescription drug, prescription pills. I had knee surgery in 2010. I was given a prescription for that. My wife was looking at it, should I fill it? I'm like, no. If I can't take the pain, I'll eat an aspirin.
Exactly.
But people, you know, having their wisdom teeth pulled, they're getting heroin or morphine tablets. They get on it. In a week, they're druggies. So, and now you have a fentanyl crisis because you don't have the heroin.
So you're telling me that the drugs are not coming on that little 12-foot boat from Venezuela?
From 1,600 kilometers away? No. With 11 people on it. I don't know where they had room for drugs on there.
And
11
engine,
people
and an engine
on
this big. That's the boat that's bringing the drugs to America.
3 tons of heroin right there, yeah, or fentanyl.
How can Americans be so stupid that they don't laugh when they see reports like that, when they see our defense secretary saying, look, we just bombed a 12-foot boat?
Actually, I should be crying. There's 11 people who may have been guilty, may have not been guilty, but were summarily murdered.
Yeah. I understand they were fishing.
Yeah. Come on. If you've got 11 people on that boat, where are the drugs going to fit?
Exactly.
Just simply as that. Normally you have two guys and you have
and
a boat full of
drugs. And how can it be coming
drugs?
To America if it's in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean somewhere and it's got an engine and enough gasoline to maybe go from
Trinidad.
Here to that building.
Yeah, next door.
It's just, it's ridiculous. It defies common sense.
But let's not forget, the CIA has been involved in two major drug scandals in the last 50 years. You had Vietnam, where they were bringing in heroin in the bodies of dead Americans, bringing it from Cambodia. And then you had the Iran-Contra affair.
Honduras.
They were bringing in cocaine.
There. Yeah. I was there. I covered it.
Crack,
I went to prison. I was taken into a prison to meet a guy named Manuel Noriega.
Oh, really?
He was in Miami. He was in the federal detention center in Miami. And it was creepy. I went all down these stairs, and then they went into this area, and they had to search you. And then finally you go into this room, and there he is. And he's got his uniform on. He's got his general's uniform, and he was very proud of that. And so, Stan, I asked him, I said, Mr. President, because he wanted to be called, he was still the president. And I said, before you became president, who did you work for? He said, I worked for the CIA. And I said, did you have direct reports? He goes, Bush.
Oh, not bad.
The guy who later on became the president of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
Bush. So here's a guy. And so he basically said he was installed. I mean, he gave me his whole story. I mean, and what did we accuse him of? Drug running.
Yeah.
Who put him there?
Absolutely.
We
absolutely.
Did. We did. Yeah.
And, you know, you want to fight drugs, you got to fight not the supply side, you got to fight the demand side.
Of course.
If there's no demand, supply can only create a certain amount of demand. Demand creates a lot of supply.
Of course.
But while we're at it, the cartels, there was a report that came out yesterday. I was reading the cartels have gotten a lot of drone training from the Ukrainians. They've also got javelins, they got stingers off the black market from the Ukrainians.
Right.
So they got Mexican cartels sending people to boot camp in Ukraine now.
So do you think where the situation is now that there's any possibility that Ukraine can somehow turn this around?
No.
They're done?
Look, you know, Zelensky signed a bill allowing to invite. You know, we understand what means invite in Ukraine. They come grip you, rip you out of your house, grab you off the street, break your arms, legs if they need to, throw you in a van and drive you away.
Well, we've seen the pictures.
Yeah, that's invite 60-plus-year-olds to service. 60-plus-year-olds. I mean, sure, they're going to go into some retirement home and take a bunch of 70-year-olds.
That means they're coming for me.
But, hey, they don't have to pay them retirement money, though. The pensions get paid.
Yeah.
So I guess I save money on that, too.
So who are all those people who left and are now living in Poland? Was that the moneyed class?
Well, the moneyed class went everywhere, but I don't think they stayed in Poland.
So why did all these people leave the country? Why is it that most of the people who could have fought in this war are gone?
Well, because they understand. Well, first of all, let's not forget that about 7 million Ukrainians moved to Russia.
Right.
About 2 million were already in Russia, working Russia, and they stayed in Russia, brought their families over. Another 7 million or so went through Belarus, Poland, Belarus, and into Russia.
Huh.
And sometimes across the borders when the borders, where the lines weren't fully formed. There were actual contraband agents that were coyotes. They were bringing people in from Kharkov into Bryansk and into Kursk Oblast to get them across the borders. Well, Bryansk, they'd actually be going through Sumy. But so there's that. There's a lot of, plus all the people that are within the four provinces. So about a third of the Ukrainian population went to Russia one way or the other.
Now, this is fascinating what
and
you just said.
Nobody talks about that.
This is fascinating what you just said, because if you actually Google it, you'll find out he's absolutely 100% correct. Go and Google, where are the majority of the immigrants or war refugees or whatever the hell they call them, who have left Ukraine as a result of the war in Ukraine? Where have they gone? Number one place, by far, Russia.
Yeah.
When have you ever seen a situation where the people of a country are so-called invaded by another country and they all decide to go to the country who invaded them? Must not be a very good invader.
Nah. There's another little secret that they don't talk about is how many Ukrainian POWs have put in for Russian citizenship.
How many POWs applied for really?
Russian citizenship? I mean, you didn't see American POWs in German camps putting in for
German citizens. Right, yeah, or the Polish.
Can I join the Germans?
No.
But you're seeing that probably about a fourth
That's
right now.
That's an important part of this story. Yeah. So, it really is.
So there's what people don't understand, if you just go into the history of Ukraine. First of all, the very word Ukraine, in Russian it's Ukraina, in Polish it's Ukraina. Ukraina means cry, edge. It's to translate into English, hinterland.
Mm-hmm.
You've never seen a nation called hinterland, because it can't be a nation called hinterland, because a hinterland is something is the edge of something bigger.
Yeah.
So, but we have a nation called hinterland.
Interesting.
And full of hinterlandians, if we're going to translate it correctly into English. That's Ukraina, Ukraine. So right off the bat, you know something's wrong with that. But in the 1920s, so Ukraine before that was Mala Russia, Little Russia, and Nova Russia, New Russia.
Yeah.
These are two major provinces, and Crimea was actually part of Kuban, the governorship of Kuban. And those are the two governorships. And then you have the little provinces within the governorships. So when the Soviets took over, the Bolsheviks took over, they had a divide and rule plan. So the majority of the population is Russian in the Russian Empire, and still is. So they started Ukrainization, forced Ukrainization. You can pull up newspapers from the archives, started from about 1922-23, going up to about 1936 when Stalin stopped it.
Mm.
And it's written in there how many people were sent to Ukrainian language schools, this and that, because you couldn't be in any kind of management position if you didn't speak Ukrainian, which was always before that considered basically a sub-dialect of Russian, one of the southern dialects. So if you didn't pick that up, it's flat out. It's in the archives. It's in the newspapers. Stalin stopped it in 1936 because they figured out, we're creating this Nazi type, ultra-nationalist entity there. And we don't want that. We've gone too far. But that's what happened. That's what happened in Kyiv. That's what happened, that happened in central Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And they tried to do that in eastern Ukraine, but it didn't work in eastern Ukraine. Everybody still considers themselves Russian.
That's what most people don't understand about that whole situation is the closeness. I was doing an interview yesterday with an Israeli official, an IDF intel guy, in fact, Mordecai, and he was very interesting. And the argument I was making to him and others is he wanted to compare what they're doing to what Russia's doing. I said, no, sir, you're absolutely wrong. This is a grudge match that you and the Palestinians are in. I'm sorry, you hate the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. You deplore the Palestinians. Your government wants to get rid of the Palestinians. You want to eradicate them. That is nothing like what's happening between right. Russia and Ukraine. Russians do not hate Ukrainians. Ukrainians do not hate Russians. It's a completely different story. They're two totally different conflicts. And I think it's important for people to understand, just factually, there's something between 11 and 13,000 civilians who've died in this war in Ukraine. It's horrible. One is too much.
Right.
But there's like 80,000, maybe many more civilians who have died in the small time, in a smaller area, in the war in Gaza right now. So there's a big difference between these two cases, down to a minute, by the way.
When you look at UN, what the UN statistics are, that 10,000-something, 12,000 civilians have died in Ukraine, Ukrainians. But what they don't tell you is the vast majority of those civilians are on the Russian side of the front. Yeah. They're getting bombed every single day by storm shadows, by HIMARS-based missile systems.
That's a great point.
They don't tell you that.
Civilian, yeah, that doesn't mean that they were killed by Russians. They
exactly.
could have been killed by Ukrainians or by the Ukrainian military, we should say.
But if you don't know that, you're going to think that, you know, that's how it is.
Final question, just curious. Yes. What do you miss about America?
Well, my friends, several of whom don't want to talk to me because they unfortunately got brainwashed over this conflict. My friends, Cajun food. Good Southern cooking.
In North Carolina. Wow.
Well, I lived in Texas for about 4 years, too.
Yeah, so you know, it's funny.
There's a lot of Cajun food
My
there.
Son married a Louisiana gal, and I love Cajun food.
Oh, yeah.
It's the best.
There's nothing
it's
like
whole
it.
Creek. Well, I'm Cuban, so it's kind of similar to what we eat. Everything just kind of mixed together. In Russia, they don't mix their foods.
No, not
you
like
your
that.
You got steak, your potato, and then you get kind of like Minnesota, where I went to school.
Well, the Germans and Russians, we're the same in that.
You are a delight to talk to. I mean, what an experience, what a life. You're so knowledgeable, you're so wise, and it's just fascinating to have this conversation with you. I can't wait to be able to talk to you once again. There's so much in this world that you can share with us, and I thank you so much for doing that. Well, that's it for us. We, as we said earlier, understand that the situation with Charlie Kirk is a difficult one for many people. It was especially difficult to watch it happen. We're going to follow the story. If they catch the assassin, obviously we will report that to you immediately. Meanwhile, this is The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. You can catch my podcast, by the way, on Journalistically Speaking, where we're going to take some cuts of the conversation that we just had. And of course, we can continue the conversation on X. You can find me at Rick Sanchez TV. Thanks so much for being with us. And we'll see you next time. Dale.